Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're glad to see such a great turnout tonight. And we're very happy to welcome Gary Taubes with his new book, Why We Get Fat and What We to Do About It. I'm going to read it. Gary was born in Rochester, New York, and studied applied physics at Harvard and aerospace engineering at Stanford. Then he went on to get a writing degree, and he's won...
A lot of awards.
Lots. the Science and Society Award of the National Association of Science Writers. He's won that three times. And he was awarded an MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellowship in 1996 and 97. His first book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, which is called, let's see, The Diet Delusion in the UK. So if you want to recommend it to any of your British friends, have them check for that. Was on the New York Times bestseller list. So let's welcome him with his new book and see what he has to say.
Thank you very much. I have to boot up my notes. I'm not used to giving this talk without visuals, although I want to ask, how many of you have seen my lecture online? Often when I lecture, there's a lot of devoted... Okay, so enough so that I can kind of go through this without... only boring about 20% of you who can will tolerate it. I just want to give you a little bit of my background because I have the physics engineering thing, which is kind of odd for somebody who's now a sort of minor diet guru. In 1984, I started off as science writing in 1981. I wanted to be an investigative reporter, and I couldn't actually get any jobs in investigative reporting, so I had to become a science writer. And in 1984, I went to live at CERN, the big nuclear physics laboratory in Geneva, thinking I was going to chronicle a great breakthrough. And what happened instead is I ended up following the misadventures of 150-odd very, very smart people as they discovered non-existent elementary particles, and ended up writing an expose about this. It was called Nobel Dreams. And I became obsessed with this question of how hard it is to do science right and how easy it is to get the wrong answer. And it's funny, when the book came out, the main character was a kind of Machiavellian Nobel Prize winner. And my publisher, as a way of getting press for the book, leaked some of the stuff in the book to page 6 of the New York Post, which is a gossip page. And the day the book came out, the headline on page 6 was Egghead Squabble Over Nobel Prize. And this Nobel Prize winner was quoted calling me an asshole in the New York Post, quote unquote. And I literally thought, like, I'm 30 years old. I thought, I'm never going to work again. This is the end of my career. And what happened instead is every time I interviewed people, they'd say, you know, you think this guy, Carlo Rubio, was bad. You should do a story on so-and-so. He's really terrible. So I actually ended up doing investigative science journalism, and I went from one story to another. I wrote a book about cold fusion, which was one of the great scientific fiascos of the late 1980s. I actually wrote it. I was trying to get out of science writing. I was living in L.A. trying to be a screenwriter, and the cold fusion happened. My publishers called me up and said, would you write about this? And I thought I could do it in 9 months and bank enough money to write screenplays for 2 years, and then I got obsessed, as I often do, and I spent 3 years on this book, and it's interviewed 300 people, and it's sort of the definitive case study in bad science. And some of my friends in the physics community, of whom I had a lot, said to me after cold fusion, you know, if you think the science of cold fusion is bad, you should look at some of this stuff in public health. And they were particularly interested in this idea that electromagnetic fields from power lines give you cancer, which actually grew out of some Colorado research, if I remember correctly. Anyway, the science was terrible. And so I started writing about that, and then I started writing about the science of that kind of science, which was epidemiology. And one thing led to another, and I was pretty much buried in public health research, and yet always applying what I had learned from, you know, when I was writing about cold fusion and high-energy physics, I got tutored in what was good science by some extremely smart, extremely rigorous experimental scientists. So they were telling me how science should be done right while I was studying how it was done wrong. And I think what I came away from it with is some very sort of strict rules about what you have to do to get the right answer and how easily you should reject a hypothesis if you know that people are not following those kind of rules. So all of this led to, and I did some stories, I spent a year working on a story for Science on salt and high blood pressure. And while I was doing that research, I was interviewing this guy who took credit for getting Americans to eat less fat and less eggs and less salt. And he was easily one of the five worst scientists I'd ever interviewed. And I'd done this book on cold fusion where I'd interviewed some of the worst scientists, I hope, in the world. And I literally put the phone down and I called this guy up and I said, I called up my editor. And I said, I just interviewed one of the five worst scientists in the world, I think, and he took credit for getting Americans to eat less fat and less eggs. And so when I'm done with the salt story, I'm going to do a story on dietary fat. I don't know what the story is, but I'm betting that if this guy was involved in any substantive way, there's a good story there. And this was 1999, and I spent a year on this one story for Science. It came out, it was called The Soft Science of Dietary Fat, and it concluded in effect that our belief that a low-fat diet is a healthy diet is based on, you know, almost non-existent evidence. Just the personalities and the arguing and the bullying of a half dozen researchers who decided it was right long before they ever did the studies. And this led me in turn to pitch an article to the New York Times Magazine in 2001 in which I just wanted to know what caused the obesity epidemic. There were two possibilities. One was high fructose corn syrup, because high fructose corn syrup came in 1978 and it saturated the market by 1984, and then we started drinking more and more caloric sweeteners in general. So that was one possibility. And the other possibility was this idea that a low-fat diet is a healthy diet, which also got institutionalized beginning in 1977 and was sort of became conventional wisdom dogma by 1984. And if you're eating a low-fat diet, you're eating a high-carbohydrate diet. That's why the food pyramid, the base of the food pyramid, is all, you know, pasta, bread, potatoes, and rice, etc. And up until the 1960s, those foods were considered uniquely fattening. So the low-fat, the whole idea that a low-fat diet is a heart-healthy diet turned the carbohydrate from something that was uniquely fattening to a heart-healthy diet food. You know, in the 1960s, my mother believed that a baked potato was fattening. By the 1980s, I don't know how many of you old enough to remember, we all ate baked potatoes. You know, that was a diet food, and you just didn't eat the butter and the sour cream. So that was my other hypothesis, and I ended up, while I was doing this story, I came upon five trials of the Atkins diet, where they compared the Atkins diet versus low-calorie, low-fat, American Heart Association-type diets. On one hand, you have a high-fat, high-saturated fat diet where you could eat as much as you want. On the other hand, you have a low-fat, low-calorie diet where you're eating small portions of skinless chicken breasts with lettuce. And the Atkins diet in each one of these trials did better, not just on weight loss, but on heart disease risk factors. So this was sort of fascinating because you've got these studies that show, you know, our hypothesis is that a high-fat, high-saturated fat diet will kill you. But if you actually do a clinical trial with overweight and obese people, you find out that a high-fat, high-saturated fat diet actually, you know, improves heart disease risk factors and leads to weight loss. So I wrote this piece for the New York Times Magazine that was a kind of famous cover story. That the cover was, "What if fat doesn't make you fat?" There was a photo of a porterhouse steak with a pat of butter on it. And easily the most controversial article probably that they've ever done. It was seen as an apologia for the Atkins diet. I was pilloried by the Center for Science and the Public Interest and various health writers who had spent their whole life pushing low-fat diets. And I also got a very large book advance to write a book. Okay, that's the good news. So, you know, I got $700,000. I was living in Manhattan. My agent took a cut. The money lasted 4 years. I spent 5 years on the book. So anytime you read that somebody wrote a book because they wanted to make money, don't believe it. And the result was my last book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. That was 5 years. And much of what I ended up learning in the course of my research, I actually didn't believe when I wrote the 2002 New York Times Magazine story. One of the things I could do in the early part of the 21st century was I could read all the literature, every relevant article. You could locate and track down and find a library that had it and get it copied and get it shipped to you. I could buy virtually every book on the subject. So I recreated the history of obesity by buying conference proceedings from every conference on obesity prior to 1985. And, you know, these would be in libraries, and the libraries wouldn't want them, and some bookstore somewhere in the world would be selling them for $5 a copy, and you could find them on bookfinder.com and have you mail to them. So I actually, you know, in the course of doing this book, I recreated the history of obesity research and nutrition research, and I learned a lot of very important things. But I also learned that you can't write a 500-page book that challenges everyone's conventional wisdom and expect doctors and people to be able to get through it. So I then turned around 2 years later, and decided I was going to write, in effect, the airplane reading version, the argumentative version of Good Calories, Bad Calories. Good Calories, Bad Calories is a densely annotated revisionist history and science, like an academic work with a faux diet book title that my editors hope would fool 20 or 30,000 people into buying it as a diet book. And my favorite reviews on Amazon are, "This is the worst diet book I ever read." Like, get to the goddamn point already, you know? And then somebody else will comment. People can comment on reviews on Amazon. It's not a diet book. But the correct answer is, then why did they call it Good Calories, Bad Calories? Anyway, so that's why I'm here. That's why a guy with a physics degree from Harvard and an engineering degree from Stanford is talking about why we get fat. And what I want to do is try and convince you that it's not what you think. I mean, some of you have read my book, so you know what you should think. But it's not what you think. And the context here is more than, like, when people write this up in the newspapers, it's always about the diet wars. You know, should you go on a low-fat diet or an Atkins diet or the skinny bitch diet or the, you know, it's not about the diet wars. It's literally about why we get fat. What causes obesity, and there's an obesity epidemic in America, and what causes diabetes? In the past 30 years, diabetes diagnoses in this country have tripled. So obesity and its associated chronic diseases are going to overwhelm the medical system. Alzheimer's might beat it too, might do it before they can, but if Alzheimer's doesn't, then they will. And one line that the doctor at UCSF likes to use is that you cannot have healthcare reform unless we have obesity reform. So it's essentially, to me, the most important issue out there is why we get fat, okay? And one thing to realize is as you get more increasingly obese, you increase your risk of a whole lot of diseases, not just diabetes and heart disease, but cancer and Alzheimer's. Okay, so there's a very good chance that whatever makes us fat also causes cancer on some fundamental level and also causes Alzheimer's. And actually, one of the reasons why dietary fat had been blamed for cancer in the 1980s was the same logic. If obesity is caused by eating too much fat and heart disease is, then, and the line was, what's good for the heart is good for the brain, which is true. But the question is fat good for the heart or bad for the heart? And are carbohydrates good for the heart or bad for the heart? Because whichever is good is probably good for the brain, and bad is vice versa. So the question is, why do we get fat? And the conventional wisdom is obvious, and I like to quote the National Institutes of Health says obesity occurs when a person consumes more calories from food than he or she burns. The Surgeon General says overweight is a result of caloric imbalance, too few calories expended for the amount of calories consumed. The conventional wisdom, this is it, energy in. If your energy in is greater than energy out, that's why you get fat. You know, we overeat. That's one way to put it. Anytime somebody says you're overeating, that means you're getting fatter because you're taking in positive more calories than you expend. Michael Phelps can eat 12,000 calories a day. He's not overeating because he expends 12,000 calories a day. You could eat 1,501 calories a day, and if you only burn 1,500, you're getting fatter and you're overeating. That's the logic. Okay, how many people believe this? One, two, three, four. Come on, be honest. I know I'm going to talk you out of it, but, you know. I mean, it seems, I believed in 2002, I was recently reading my New York Times Magazine story, and I had a line saying excess calories obviously is what makes you fat. So the question is, where do the excess calories come from? And one thing you want to do in science is the whole idea, the whole process of science is about explaining observations. So we see something in nature, or we create in the laboratory, we want to explain it. And that's what the science is all about. So we want to explain the obesity epidemic. We have this hypothesis that you get fat because you take in more calories than you expend. So now we have to explain the obesity epidemic. Why did obesity in this country start rising somewhere in the 1970s, 1980s? So it went from 12, 13% up to 33, 34% of the population's obese. And the way it's explained today is by basically we got richer. Marion Nestle, who's a New York University nutritionist, says, you know, increased prosperity caused the epidemic. There's food everywhere. It's easy to get. We're all rich enough to buy it. We don't have to work for a living. But, you know, I've had people say, you know, that when they got rid of if you don't have to roll your car window down, that's like a pound a year that you gain because you don't, you have the, you know, my brother, who's a mathematician at Harvard and a bit weird, actually still tries to buy cars where you got to roll the thing, he thinks. Increased prosperity. Carolee Brown now, who's a psychologist at Yale. Whoa, get back here. Go away. Sorry. Kelly Brown now says we live in a toxic environment, okay? And the toxic environment is defined as an environment that encourages overeating and physical inactivity. And this is how Kelly described it. He said, cheeseburgers and french fries, drive-in windows and supersizes, soft drinks and candy, potato chips and cheese curls. Once unusual, as much our background as trees, grass, and clouds. Few children walk or bike to school. There's little physical education. Computers, video games, and television keep children inside and inactive. Parents are reluctant to let children roam free to play. So basically, we have too much tasty food available. You know, you can't drive around the block without seeing a McDonald's or a Burger King. We don't get enough physical activity. We're not driven. You know, I've had one researcher say we don't have to hunt down woolly mammoths for dinner. Mammoth is. So increased prosperity, toxic environment causes overeating, energy in over energy out, and that caused the obesity and the obesity epidemic. And the question you want to ask is this true? Okay? Does it explain the observations? You know, it's a hypothesis. It sounds obvious. 40 years ago, there weren't a lot of McDonald's around. There were a lot, but there weren't as many as there are today. Now there's more McDonald's. There's more fast food. There's more junk food. We're less physically active than ever, except that we're not, but that's another story. And we got fatter. So is this causal? Did this do it? And one of the things I did in my books, I said, let's just look and see if we could find some observations that might be, you know, counterexamples that might give us another idea what's really going on. And what I came upon is what I call the Fat Louisa paradox. And Fat Louisa was a Pima Indian, an obese Pima Indian. It was photographed in 1902 by a Harvard anthropologist named Frank Russell. And the Pima Indians, they're now on a reservation in Arizona, south of Phoenix. They used to be the most affluent Native American tribe in the United States. Okay, they were hunters and gatherers. They were farmers. They raised pigs and cattle. They ate fish and clams from the Gila River. I mean, there are these wonderful stories where, you know, army battalions are crossing the Pima territory and they're starving, and like three Pima, you know, adolescents come and visit the camp, and they ask the adolescents if they could get them some food, and they'll trade them these nice plaid shirts for whatever food they could dig up in the middle of Arizona. And the adolescents say, we'll be back tomorrow. And they come back like 6 hours later with, you know, 57 fish and three deer and what, you know, enough to feed like three battalions. So what happens is These people were lean and in fine health. That's how they were described by the battalions that passed through. And then in 1849, gold is discovered in California. And you get the 49er gold rush. And the Santa Fe Trail is the southernmost of three routes to California, runs through the Pima territory. And the U.S. government actually asked the Pima to feed the 49ers who went through their territory. There were 20 to 60,000 of them, depending on which anthropologist you're reading, who traveled through the Pima territory in the 1850s, 1860s. But then they started settling in Arizona. The Anglo-Americans did, the Mexicans did, and they started taking the Pima's, the Gila River water, and they diverted it to irrigate their own fields so the Pima couldn't have it anymore, and they overhunted the local mountains. And by the 1870s, the Pima were starving. And they went through 30 years of starvation. And by 1902, when Frank Russell comes, the Pima are now on a reservation. Their land has been turned into a reservation. They're subsisting on government rations for food. And they have an obesity problem. And the way Russell puts it is, he says, many old persons exhibit a degree of obesity that is in striking contrast with the tall and sinewy Indian conventionalized and popular thought. So the interesting thing about the Pima is, our hypothesis says that if you go from poverty to affluence, you get fat. But the Pima went from affluence through 30 years of famine to poverty, and obesity appears in the reservation. And 30 years of famine, that's 30 years of basically being on a diet, right? So that should make you lean, not fat. So it kind of goes against all of our ideas. And this would be, if it was the only case, it would be kind of meaningless. But there are actually a lot of these examples in the literature. And when you write a book like this, there's a tendency to get mad at the medical establishment. Because why is it that I went back to look for them and they didn't? Because if you're going to blame obesity on a toxic environment and the food industry and the fast food industry, one of the first things you'll do is, let's see if we could find obesity in populations that don't have a food industry, don't have a fast food industry. So Sioux Indians, the South Dakota Crow Creek Reservation in 1928, a couple University of Chicago economists went to study them, and they reported that the living conditions on this reservation, it's hard for us to imagine the poverty on a Native American reservation in the 1920s. Actually, there was a government report done in 1927 that said it was hard for people in 1927 to imagine the poverty on these reservations. So these people lived in 1 to 2 room shacks, quote, unfit for occupancy. There were 4 to 8 people per room. 40% of the children on the reservation lived in homes without toilets. If you wanted drinking water, you had to walk down to the river to get it. 15 families with 32 children lived chiefly on bread and coffee. And yet 40% of the women, 25% of the men, and 10% of the children on the reservation were described as distinctly fat. And another 20% of the women and 25% of the men and children were described as extremely thin. So what you had on this reservation is a coexistence of obesity and malnutrition or subnutrition in the same population. There was all kinds of signs of malnutrition in this population. And yet some of the women were obese, distinctly fat, and a lot of them seemed to be starving, as did some of the children. And we're going to come back to that observation. African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina in 1959, the family incomes were $9 to $53 a week, which is about the equivalent of $360 max a week today, and yet 18% of the men and 30% of the women were obese. Zulus in Durban, South Africa, 40% of the women were obese, and the women in their 40s averaged 175 pounds. The average weight of American women today, I think, is 165 pounds. Trinidad, 1961 to 63, there was a malnutrition crisis going on in Trinidad. People were starving and dying of malnutrition. The U.S. government sends a team of nutritionists down to help them out, and they come back reporting that a third of the women over 25 are obese, and that obesity is a potentially, quote, potentially serious medical problem in women. And the per capita daily diet, which was calculated the following year by an MIT nutritionist, was less than 2,000 calories a day, lower than what the Food and Agriculture Organization was saying was necessary for a healthy diet, and it was 21% fat. So it was a high-carb, low-fat diet. Bantu pensioners in South Africa, these are the poorest of the poor of a disenfranchised population in South Africa. 30% of the women are, quote, severely overweight, and the mean weight of women over 60 was 165 pounds. Rarotonga in the South Pacific, 25% of the women were described as grossly obese. That was 1971. Factory workers in Chile in 1974, most were engaged in heavy labor. Okay, so these aren't people, they're not training for marathons, they're not, you know, going to the gym every day, they're not trying to walk an hour a day like we're told to do by the government, but they're working in a factory doing heavy labor. 30% were obese. Nearly 50% of the women over 54 are obese. And 10% suffer undernourishment, which is this combination, again, of obesity and malnutrition or subnutrition in the same populations. And the last study was that by the 1980s, obesity is like a cottage industry, and everyone's measuring obesity everywhere, and they're already blaming it on fast food. But a University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center cardiologist studied Mexican Americans in Starr County, Texas, which is right on the border of Mexico, about 200 miles due south of San Antonio. And he reported that 50% of women in their 50s were obese and 40% of the men in their 40s. And the living conditions, quote, most inhabitants are employed in agricultural labor and or work in the oil fields in the country. So these are poor, hardworking people. There was one restaurant in Starr County in 1981, a Mexican restaurant, nothing else. There's no McDonald's, there's no Burger King. So there's no aspect of this toxic environment as it's described today. They probably didn't even have in 1981, they might have had high fructose corn syrup. But yet they had these levels of obesity that are, you know, match what we have today. And what's interesting is William Mueller, the guy who did the study, even said, you know, these are Mexican Americans. They're poor, but they're Americans. They had their high school yearbooks. All the kids were thin. And the parents were thin in high school, too. And then they became obese somewhere. By the time they hit their late 20s, that's when the obesity manifested itself, which was the same kind of observation that was seen in Trinidad. So the question you want to ask is, why were these people fat? Because we can rule out some things. By looking at different populations, we can rule out, you know, variables. Like we could rule out the McDonald's and Burger King and the food industry. We could probably rule out this easy availability of food because most of these people were dirt poor. We could rule out sedentary behavior because a lot of these people were extremely hardworking. They certainly weren't keeping their kids home from school. The kids had to walk down to the river and the Sioux Indian tribe just to get water. So Occam's razor said whatever makes these people fat probably makes us fat. And what we want to know is why were they fat? And in 1973, early 1960s, a British diabetes specialist named Ralph Richards went to the Jamaica and set up a diabetes clinic at the University of West Indies. And he reported in 1973 that 10% of the men and 2/3 of the adult women in Jamaica were obese. And he asked this question with an open mind. This is how we should have. And he said, it's difficult to explain the high frequency of obesity seen in a relatively impecunious society such as exists in the West Indies when compared to the standard of living enjoyed in the more developed countries. Okay, it's difficult. You know, it's the same thing. These people are poor. Why are they fat? When the affluent people aren't, it should be the other way around, right? Malnutrition and subnutrition are common disorders in the first 2 years of life in these areas and account for almost 25% of all admissions to pediatric wards in Jamaica. Subnutrition continues in early childhood to the early teens. Obesity begins to manifest itself in the female population from the 25th year of life and reaches enormous proportions from 30 onward. Okay. Now, the same question was asked in 2005, and that whistle I did, I just realized that she wants me to wrap up at 8:15. I was thinking it started at 7:30, not at 7. We start at 7:30, right? So that's 45. Yeah, I haven't given a 45-minute talk in my life. So you're going to get the first half. You're going to get the why we don't get fat. You may not get the why we get fat part, but you'll get the why we don't get fat part. Okay, I'll see what I could do. Yeah. I mean, I could sign quick. A few years ago, this is Benjamin Caballero, head of the Laboratory of Human Nutrition at Johns Hopkins, writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, a pretty good journal, called A Nutrition Paradox, Underweight and Obesity in Developing Countries. There's that combination we saw in 1928. It says, a few years ago, I was visiting a primary care clinic in the slums of Sao Paulo, Brazil. The waiting room was full of mothers with thin, stunted young children. exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition. Their appearance, sadly, would surprise few who would visit poor urban areas in the developing world. What might come as a surprise is that many of the mothers holding these undernourished infants were themselves overweight. And then he says, the coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to public health programs, since the aims of programs to reduce undernutrition are obviously in conflict with those for obesity prevention. If you want to prevent undernutrition, you make more food available, right? And if you want to prevent obesity, you make less food available. And the point I make is that it doesn't pose a challenge to public health programs, it poses a challenge to your paradigm. Because if you believe these women got fat because they ate too much, they ate superfluous calories that they weren't burning off while their children are starving, then you believe that these women are willing to starve their children to death so they could eat calories they don't need. They can sneak out and eat a Snickers bar that if they gave to their kid would even benefit from. How many are mothers here? Would you do that? Okay, my mother wouldn't. So we either throw out everything we know about maternal behavior or we throw out our obesity paradigm. To me, this is one of the fundamental observations in the field. You know, if you got an obese mother with a starving child, that mother did not get fat by eating too much. Because if she had excess food, she'd have given it to her son or daughter. So there are other inconvenient observations. I'm going to have to go through this quickly that our overeating hypothesis can cure. For instance, undereating doesn't cure obesity. And if you look at clinical trials and you tell people to eat less, to eat calorie-restricted diets, you know, the way they're reviewed is the findings are always too small to be clinically insignificant. You can get people to lose weight for about 6 months, and then they put it back on, and they're hungry all the time. And should this come as a surprise? And Hilda Brook, who's a leading expert on childhood obesity in the mid-20th century, put it this way. She said, more than in any other illness, a physician treating the obese patient is called upon only to do a special trick, to make the patient do something, stop eating, after it has already been proved that he cannot do it. If you are obese or overweight, you have known your whole life that you should be eating less. It obviously doesn't work. And the question is, why not? Exercising more doesn't work. That's another problem. So increasing your energy expenditure doesn't work. And I could cite studies after studies. My favorite evidence is 2007 physical activity guidelines by the American Heart Association, American College of Sports Medicine. These are people who want us to exercise. They think exercise is an inherent part of a healthy lifestyle. And they said, it is reasonable to assume that persons with relatively high daily energy expenditure would be less likely to gain weight over time compared with those who have low energy expenditures. So that's logically equivalent to saying it's reasonable to assume that if you're a couch potato, you'll be less likely to gain weight over time if you start working out than if you don't. So far, they said, data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. This hypothesis is about 130 years old, maybe 150. And one of the points I learned from my physicist friends is if you can't come up with compelling evidence to support a hypothesis after 100 years of work, there's a very good chance that it's wrong. It doesn't mean it is. Maybe you just didn't do the studies right. That's how the government thinks. We just didn't do the study right. How many of you have exercised a lot and never lost a pound? There we go. Okay. Doesn't work. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is pretty obvious, okay? Oh, we got another one. Is that a question or a... Oh, I'm sure there's tons of them. I mean, lean people control their weight well. The question is, would they have trouble controlling their weight if they didn't exercise? When I was writing this, I wrote this story about this for New York Magazine that was synopsized from Good Calories, Bad Calories. And I interviewed a guy named Peter Wood at Stanford University, who's one of the leading proponents. He's an exercise physiologist who's been studying exercise and weight and health since the 1970s, a leading proponent of the need to exercise regularly. And Peter told me, you know, I'm 135 pounds, I'm 5'7", I've run 37 different marathons, and I've been 135 pounds, whether I was training for a marathon or whether I had plantar fasciitis and didn't get to work out for a year. And I said, Peter, do you realize what you just said? You just said that the amount you exercised had zero influence on your weight. And he went, you know, I never thought about that. And then I interviewed a guy at the University of South Carolina whose name's going to escape me at the moment. I named him in the article, I do not name him in Why We Get Fat, who also has been studying exercise for 30 years. And this guy is a marathon runner also. And he said that he was short, fat, and bald when he started running 30 years ago. Since then, he has run approximately 85,000 miles, more than three times around the Earth at the equator, and he's short, fatter, and more bald. He's gained 35 pounds despite running 85,000 miles, and I said to him, here's the question, do you think you would not have gained that weight had you run even more? And he said, I don't know how I could have fit more running in my life, because I was already running about 2 hours a day. But had I, yeah, maybe I would have, you know. And this man was trapped in a paradigm. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is you get trapped in a paradigm. Here's another point. The U.S. Dietary Guidelines, let's say I go to 8:30. U.S. Dietary Guidelines just came out, okay, they said eat less. That one of the two overarching concepts is maintaining energy balance to sustain weight and achieve a healthy weight. So what does it take to maintain energy balance? Anyone ever think about that? Now, you can do this calculation, and I wish the USDA had, because it's very simple. But a typical American's food intake is about 2,700 calories a day. That's 1 million calories a year. That's men and women combined. Okay, that's 1 million calories a year. It's 10 million calories in a decade. It's about 10 tons of food. 10 to 12 tons of food in a decade. And now you ask yourself, how well do I have to maintain energy balance, match calories in to calories out, so that I don't gain 20 pounds in a decade, which is 40 pounds in two decades? So I don't want to go from being lean in my 20s to being obese in my 40s, which many people do. So I want to practice energy balance because USDA tells me to. And you can do this calculation. And then the answer is that if you overshoot by 20 calories a day, if you stick 20 calories a day in your fat tissue that you don't burn, you will gain 40 pounds in 20 years. You'll gain 2 pounds a year. The calculation's pretty easy. It's like 20 times 20 calories times 365 days in a year times 10 years divided by 3,500 calories per pound of fat, and you come out to 21 pounds in a decade. Okay? So if you want to just not be obese 20 years from now, you have to match calories in and calories out to better than 20 calories. If you don't want to gain any weight, you basically have to match it perfectly. Now, no human being can do this. Okay? Even if I could find, I don't know, somewhere out there, there's a Guinness Book of World Record calorie counter, and I will guarantee that he or she, and I hate sexist, probably a she, cannot match calories into calories out to better than 20 calories. Because you don't even know what you're expending. I mean, doctors are going to calculate it when they go in the lab, and the techniques they have don't actually have that kind of accuracy. It's better than 0.1% accuracy. And the reason for this analogy, the reason for this exercise, is to make the point that, you know, you could say, like, okay, let's imagine, here's one way you could do it. I start getting fatter. So now I undereat. So I walk away from the table, I go on a diet, so I lose the weight I've gained, and then I go back to eating what I want to eat, and I gain the weight. So I basically oscillate around energy balance. But then you have to ask your question, how do animals do it? Because animals don't look in a mirror, they don't know they're getting fatter, they don't have a belt that they have to let out. So how do animals match calories in, calories out perfectly so they don't get obese? And I got this calculation actually from a 1937 textbook written by the foremost expert in nutrition, metabolism in the United States prior to the Second World War, a fellow named Eugene Dubois. And Dubois did this calculation. And he said, there's no stranger phenomenon than the maintenance of a constant body weight under marked variation in bodily activity and food consumption. Because nobody can do this. And the question is, not why are some of us fat, but if that's what we have to do to remain lean, match calories into calories, why aren't all of us fat? Okay? Because it's like one bite too many of food every day that goes into your fat tissue, and you will eventually get obese. Why aren't we all fat? And it just shows you that there's a problem with the way we think about it. That all you have to do is think about the actual numbers, and it's crazy. The hypothesis is crazy. There are other reasons this hypothesis problems. You know, men and women fatten differently, okay? Men put on fat above the waist. Women put on fat below the waist. If you put on fat above the waist, you increase your risk of heart disease. If you put on fat below the waist, you don't. But in both cases, you have to take in more calories than you expend. And yet, one exercise in what's called overeating doesn't increase your heart disease risk. The other does. What do the calories have to do about it? you know, you look at boys and girls, and now I'm challenging pre-World War II European clinicians and how they thought about obesity. And this is the message of my book, is how they thought about it, and then I just update it. There's nothing new in my book, okay? It's all old. And I say it over and over again, and then I get repetitive. Boys and girls enter puberty with virtually the same amount of body fat, okay? Boys lose fat and gain muscle as they go through puberty. Girls gain fat and breasts and hips and buttocks, okay? They both have to overeat. They both have to take in more calories than they're expending because they're getting bigger, okay? They're gaining weight. But the boys lose fat and gain muscle, and the girls gain fat. What did the act of overeating have to do with it? Okay, we know why they got bigger. They were secreting growth hormone. We know why they took in more calories than they expended. They were growing. They needed those calories to build new tissue, new connective tissue, new bone, new muscle. Sex hormones determined whether they gained fat or lost it and where the fat went. The fact of overeating, of this caloric imbalance that is the very core of our beliefs about weight regulation, is irrelevant. It's an effect. They overate because they were growing. And their growth was determined by hormones, and where they put their fat was determined by hormones. Animal husbandry. Here's another example. You know, we breed cattle to be more or less lean, more or less fat. And there are lean breeds of cattle, and there are fat breeds of cattle. And in my book, on page 67, I have a photo of... The reason I know the page number... It's because the photo is completely screwed up. I have a fat breed of cow and a lean breed of cow, and the problem is the fat breed of cow is a bull. I got 20 letters from people in Texas saying, you city slicker idiot, can you tell the difference between a bull and a cow? So if we go into another printing, that'll be fixed. You know, when you breed a cow to be fat, like the lean cow, dairy cow are fat, cattle are fat, you know, and the beef cattle tend to be fatty and bulky, and the question is, what are you breeding for? Are you breeding so that the dairy cow eat less per bite than the beef cattle? Are you breeding so that the beef cattle like spend 12 hours grazing and the dairy cattle only spend 10 hours? Did the breed the dairy cattle so they have the surge to exercise, and like that Far Side cartoon, as soon as it gets dark, they go for a run and the beef cow goes in and sits in the barn? And it's like absurd. Obviously, what you're breeding for is not how much they eat and exercise, but how they use the fuel they take in. The dairy cow partitions the fuel to milk, and what you want is a machine that just takes in calories, converts it to milk, and gives you milk. You don't want to waste a lot of calories, a lot of fuel, making a big, beefy animal. With the meat cow, you want a cow that's big and beefy, that's got protein and fat. So that's one way to think about it. Is the difference is when you're breeding for fat or lean is how people how animals partition the fuel. Lipodystrophies. We're going to skip this. Okay. All of this comes, the reason we believe, and now I'm really accelerating, the reason we believe that it's all about calories in and calories out is because of the laws of thermodynamics. Whenever I get a bad review of my book, somebody accuses me of not believing that the laws of thermodynamics don't apply to human beings. This has been said for like 60 years. Whenever somebody said calories don't count, that's a catchword for meaning this guy does not understand the laws of thermodynamics. Okay, the laws of I actually got a lecture on, I was on Charlie Rose when my first book came, not Charlie Rose, Larry King and Jillian Michaels, a trainer from The Biggest Loser, came on the show and gave me a lecture of thermodynamics on national television. I have a physics degree from Harvard, and it's like, I mean, I was a lousy student, but I have the piece of, you know, I was there. I understand the law of thermodynamics. I was speechless. I literally just, if, you know, you can watch it online, I didn't respond. I didn't know what to say, you know, like... And anyway, the laws of thermodynamics say that if a system gets bigger, basically it's a law of conservation of energy. So you can't make energy from whole cloth. You can't make energy disappear. So if a system gets bigger, it had to take in more energy than it expended. That's what the laws of thermodynamics tell you. If a system gets smaller, less massive, it has to expend more energy than it took in. It's a very simple law. It's always true. Always true. People, animals, everywhere in the universe, it's true. Like every other law of physics, it tells us something about the universe. It says nothing about why we get fat. Absolutely nothing. This is the biggest cock-up in the field of obesity research. It boggles my mind. It's an eighth-grade science mistake. They take a law that has no causality in it. there's an equal sign, delta E equals E in minus E out, and they put like an arrow. Actually, the arrow goes that way. It says if this changes and that changes, therefore change in energy in and energy out is what changes fat mass. One way to think about it, there are a lot of them. I'm going to use a metaphor tonight that I got from a blogger. You know, when you want to know why somebody's fat and why somebody's thin, like why does somebody have all this fat energy accumulated in their fat cells, okay? And so you say, well, because he took in more energy than he expended, right? That's the answer. That's why they've got so much fat there and it went to the fat. Let's say we want to know why Bill Gates is rich and we're not. Okay, Bill Gates is a fat cat. He has all this energy in his bank account and we're lean cats and we don't. So you say, why is Bill Gates rich and we're not? And I say, because he took in more money than he spent. It is the exact same logic, and it tells you absolutely nothing. And then if you say, well, come on, Gary, that's ridiculous. And I say, no. If he takes in more money than he spends, he'll get richer, right? Therefore, taking in more money than you spend makes you rich. And it's nonsense, and it's the exact same logic. And somehow this has slipped by. Everybody believes it. I believed it 7 years ago. I only found that, you know, you read a paper in obesity and it says obesity is, you know, a disturbance of energy balance. It's nonsense. It tells you nothing. If somebody gets fatter, they had to take in more calories than they expend. And what you want to know is why that happened. Okay, 5 minutes. Come on. What's going on here? How can I give this? I've given it 400 times. You'd think I would be able to give it without my slides. No. That would require consciousness. Skip that. Alternative hypothesis. There was an alternative hypothesis. Prior to the Second World War, all significant medical science was done in Europe. Science was a European invention. It was pioneered. It was honed in Europe. When I wrote about physics, when I lived at this physics lab, the Europeans used to say that the best thing that ever happened to American physics was Hitler, because he drove these brilliant European scientists to the United States. And if you look at, you know, Hans Bethe and Niels Bohr and all these famous physicists, Albert Einstein, you know, they all came to the United States and we embraced them because we had nuclear weapons we had to build. So in physics, this culture of science was embraced. But in medicine and in public health, it wasn't. And it's interesting, after the war, nobody cared what a German had to say about anything, okay, which is legitimate. And actually, one of the things I did in Good Calories, Bad Calories is the best obesity textbook ever published was published in 1940. It was written by a Northwestern University endocrinologist who had come over from Hungary in 1933 or 31. And he had... Two-thirds of all the references in the book was heavily referenced. Two-thirds were in German and from the German literature. The next book published was in 1948 by two Mayo Clinic doctors. They had 30 references, and 12 of them were in German. You know, we just didn't care. But the fact is, that's where science was being done. These people understood it. And their theory of obesity, they started from first principles. They said obesity is not a disorder of energy balance. Eating too much, or excess. It's a disorder of fat accumulation. You got too much excess fat accumulation. One way to put it is having too much fat is a disorder of having too much fat. The simplest possible thing you could say about this problem. But if you phrase it like that, like if you say obesity is a sort of energy balance, you want to know why people eat so much and why they're sedentary and what controls appetite and satiety, and that's all the research being done. If you say obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation, you just want to know what regulates the fat tissue. Okay, and what's ironic, I lecture a lot to medical schools. They get this lecture with slides and slowed down. And I say to them, it's 2011. Obesity is a sort of excess fat accumulation. Why is it up to me to tell you guys to study the fat tissue? And one reason they don't study the fat tissue is because it was all worked out in the 1960s. It's actually pretty simple endocrinology. Endocrinology is a study of hormones. I mean, one of the interesting histories in Good Calories, Bad Calories was as early as 1925, people were rejecting hormones as a cause of obesity because it was always seen as an excuse for a fat person to remain sedentary, to remain a glutton, when me, the lean person, is getting out there exercising and eating in moderation. So you have these definitive statements made about obesity not being a hormonal disorder when these people knew nothing about hormones. nothing. I mean, they were still called, hormonal glands were still called the ductless glands in the 19th. Insulin had been discovered 4 years earlier. We couldn't measure hormones in the blood until 1959. And we couldn't measure fatty acids in the blood until 1956. And as soon as we could, within 3 or 4 years, people figured out what regulated fat accumulation in the fat tissue. And the short answer is the hormone insulin. Insulin is, for all intents and purposes, the only hormone that puts fat in your fat tissue. And we secrete insulin. For all intents and purposes, our insulin levels are secreted, are determined by the carbohydrates we eat. So by the 1960s, what I would call the null hypothesis of obesity, the one that you would need remarkable evidence to reject, is that carbohydrates are fattening, which was the conventional wisdom at the time. And they're fattening because we secrete insulin in response to them, and the insulin makes us store calories as fat. It won't let us burn the fat. And the problem is, by the 1960s, we started believing that dietary fat caused heart disease. And therefore, we started telling everyone to eat high-carb diets. So as early as 1965, nutritionists in this country were quoted in the New York Times Magazine saying that to prescribe a low-carbohydrate diet for obesity was akin to, quote, mass murder, unquote, because you'd be giving them a high-fat diet. And a high-fat diet was supposed to cause heart disease. And the problem is, if you look at the biochemistry and the physiology and the endocrinology, carbohydrates make you fat. Okay, this is a short, when I lecture on this, you know, it's, again, I get about an hour in with doctors before I ever mention the word carbohydrates. And as soon as I do, I see about half of them go, oh no, it's that Atkins crap. It's like that quackery. He snuck on, like, he sounded like a smart guy. And now, lo and behold, he's a quack after all. You know, I completely believe him, and now I'm going to reject everything I heard up till this point. The problem is Atkins read the same literature I did. If you get rid of the carbohydrate, think of it this way, just like cigarettes cause lung cancer, not in everyone. 9 out of 10 people who smoke don't get lung cancer. Carbohydrates make you fat. And not everyone. Lean people can tolerate carbs. People put on weight easily. They put on weight easily because of the carbs in the diet. So if you don't want to be fat, you don't need to cut out the carbs. But you don't want to cut calories because it's not a calorie issue. It's a regulation of your fat tissue issue. And that's controlled by carbohydrates, and specifically the easily digestible ones. I'm not talking broccoli and kale. You know, the easily digestible ones, the liquid carbs like sodas and fruit, the sweet carbs with fructose in them, which is not anything with sugar or high fructose corn syrup is half fructose, and that is almost assuredly a fundamental problem here. But these foods make you fat. But if you get rid of them and you keep calories high, you add back fat. So now you're eating a high-fat diet. And when I first, in Good Calories, Bad Calories, the first 150 pages of the book are discussing the evidence of whether a high-fat diet will kill you. Because if it does, who cares if you lose weight? That's the conventional wisdom today. Who cares if you lose weight on the Atkins diet? The fat's going to kill you. But everything we've learned about heart disease and diabetes since the 1970s, this is 1960s era science, says that it's the carbs that cause heart disease and the carbs that cause diabetes. And I'm doing a story for the journal Science on the mechanism. Remember I said if you get fatter and overweight and obese, you increase your risk of cancer? So I'm doing a story for the journal Science, which I do most of my writing for, on the mechanism connecting obesity and diabetes to cancer. And it's insulin. High insulin levels promote tumor growth. And I came upon a professor at Harvard who probably will win a Nobel Prize in the next 5 to 10 years, and the president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, the most prestigious cancer research hospital in the United States, who do not eat refined carbs or sugars because they think it will give them cancer. Okay? You know, it's the problem is, I've just given you a unified hypothesis of chronic disease. I've just blamed everything on carbs. The caveat is, my wife says if I walk outside and I see someone get hit by a car, I'll blame that on carbs. You know, I mean, if you trip and break your leg, I'll blame that on carbs. If my kid throws a tantrum, it's obviously the sugar. I am truly obsessed. I'm focused. I'm rigid. But, you know, Good Calories, Bad Calories, the bigger book, the harder to read one, goes through all of this. And, you know, some people say excruciating detail why this is a believable hypothesis. You know, prior to the 1930s, there was 50 years of research showing that populations that didn't eat Western diets didn't get cancer. And Michael Pollan talks about this in Defense of Food. It's a very, you know, well-accepted observation. There are huge reports on food and cancer that discuss it. They blame it on the fact that overeating makes people fat, which raises insulin levels, which causes cancer. I blame it on the fact that the carbohydrates raise insulin levels, you know. But it's a there are a whole lot of threads that tie together. And the message, the ultimate message is if you're the leanest you can be is going to be on the diet with the least carbohydrates. Some are more fattening than others. Like I said, green leafy vegetables have a low carb content. They have a high fiber content, which slows down the digestion. What nutritionists call low glycemic index carbs are better than high glycemic index carbs. But, you know, if you listen to your doctor, he's going to tell you to eat less and exercise more. They're missing the point. The point is carbohydrates drive insulin, drive fat accumulation. There's a lot of other hormones involved. Women, you know, estrogen suppresses fat accumulation. So as you get older, you secrete less estrogen, you start to accumulate fat, which in turn will make you hungry. And you'll think, as a friend of mine at the New York Times does, that you have a trouble controlling portions suddenly. But you're going to do it not because you got your brain said, I'm hungry, and that's driving the fat. Your fat has decided to expand because estrogen isn't keeping it down anymore. But the one thing you can control is the diet. And that's through the carbohydrates. And that's, you know, I mean, it's not bad. This is still the shortest lecture I ever gave. Keeping independent bookstores alive.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.